Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is out today. Right after the third and final presidential debate, conservative commentator Ann Coulter tweeted, quote, "I highly approve of Romney's decision to be kind and gentle to the retard." Well, outrage to that tweet was swift, and it came from all sides, including from John Franklin Stevens, a 30-year-old athlete with Down syndrome, who wrote an open letter to Coulter urging her to apologize for her offensive comment. But Ann Coulter did not back down. Oh, no, she did not. Not on Piers Morgan Tonight on CNN.
"I was not referring to someone with Down syndrome. I was referring to the president of the United States.
I know that.
I used the word retard the same way people use idiot, cretin, moron, and the rest of them, which were all once technical terms, and I've had it with the language police, and you were wrong that, oh, no one else is laughing. Everyone is fed up with the language police."
Actually, they're not.
Well, really? Do you hear a lot of laughing out there? In this election season, when Clint Eastwood talks to an empty chair, Big Bird and binders full of women turn into instant worldwide memes, maybe Ann Coulter actually has a point. Maybe extreme speech and manufactured outrage is the way to get your message across on the media. Maybe it's turned into an industry. I mean, Ann Coulter is a pro at this. All the while she was defending her tweet from the, quote, language police, she was also using that screen time to plug her new book, Mugged: Racial Demagoguery from the 70s to Obama. That's the name of her book. Well, joining us now to talk about this emerging outrage industry is Professor Sarah Soberai. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at Tufts University. She's co-author of the forthcoming book, The Outrage Industry, that she's writing with Jeffrey Berry, who's also a professor at Tufts. Sarah Soberai, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, it's nice to be back.
It's great to have you. So tell us, when you say outrage industry, what exactly are we talking about here?
Well, first of all, when we talk about outrage in terms of what we mean, we're talking about a sort of extreme incivility, and often you'll hear people talk about incivility in politics, and we thought that usually when we were seeing that term used, like in the political communications community, it was usually talking about things like eye-rolling or interrupting, essentially a form of rudeness. And what we were noticing in the Ann Coulter instance is a great example, is that there's something more going on, something beyond incivility. And so that's what we're looking to capture. So we're talking about a whole sort of genre of political opinion programming and a certain type of discussion where folks are using language to attempt to sort of provoke an emotional response, maybe anger, fear, moral indignation, excitement, you know, these sorts of things from the audience. And in these programs, they tend to steer clear of, you know, complex political issues and instead focus on melodrama and mockery and these hyperbolic forecasts of impending doom, that sort of thing.
Do you think that's the key difference between incivility and outrage, that while incivility might be sort of a reaction, outrage and the outrage industry is instead deliberate provocation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right, that with outrage, we're talking about something that is it's far sharper and more pronounced, and I think you're really getting at the heart of it, that instead of something like an eye roll or an interruption or a sigh, that can almost be inadvertent, you know, sometimes intentional, but this is more malfeasant and more intentional. It's deployed, and you were very right, I think, to note that Ann Coulter is no dummy, and if she identifies herself as someone who's there to be provocative and to stir the pot, and that's how she herself is profitable.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah Soberai, if I may, there's a lot of questions to be asked here about the fact that you and Jeff Berry call it the outrage industry. The word industry implies that, you know, there's money involved here, that has become almost a profession. Why do you call it an industry today?
Well, I think folks will say sometimes, you know, well, we've always had, you know, vitriol in politics, and it's pretty ugly, and Father Coughlin, you know, was around in the 30s and things like that. But what's different today isn't so much the tenor of those voices, you know, the nastiness, but it's ubiquity. You know, there were voices like that, but today, in the past, but today they have a platform, many platforms, and that's because all of a sudden it's profitable in ways that this type of speech didn't used to be profitable. And so when folks see that this genre is really on the rise, I mean, it's been a very steep increase just at the same time that newspapers and broadcast news are losing viewers and readers, you know, outrage programming is increasing its audience size. But at any rate, the reason that this is sort of proliferated is because it makes money today, and it didn't used to. So if I could give you one example. So there's been, I guess, a series of things that have changed all at once over the course of maybe a couple of decades that made this work. And one example is that in the 70s, when there were three networks, the way programming on television that dominated things, the way programming decisions were largely made were with least objectionable programming in mind. What will offend the fewest number of people? Because they're trying to get a mass audience. Well, today, networks have to attract an audience in this expansive arena of cable channels and have adapted by casting much more pointedly into little homogeneous audiences, so this niche orientation. And with that in mind, networks can afford to offend segments of the market who aren't their target audience. And in fact, they deliver audiences in some ways specifically by using objectionable programming because it breaks through the clutter when you're changing channels.
But may I ask you, though, because on the other hand, the fact that, as you're saying, it's become an industry, very market-driven, very highly segmented because of cable television, doesn't that also produce sort of a natural check on the system? Because if indeed there are market forces at play here, when someone goes too far, I mean, I'm thinking about Glenn Beck here, right? They get taken off the air. Now, granted, too far is pretty far out there, but he did get taken off the air.
Yeah, I think what we've found, Glenn Beck, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about Glenn Beck is that in his case, when he was transitioned off the air, he was still, in terms of audience size, I think what's interesting, he was still tripling to quadrupling the audience size for Wolf Blitzer on CNN in the exact same. So he wasn't sort of taken off the air because his ratings had dropped or he'd lost viewers because, you know, he was too offensive. What had happened was he was becoming a loose cannon, and so he became not an advertising asset anymore.
Well, isn't that the key thing, though, that it may not be that he's offending viewers, but he's offending the people who are going to pay for ad time on the show?
Right, but his case is, well, first of all, he's doing quite well still, but his case is somewhat of an exception. If you look at Rush Limbaugh with the Sandra Fluck in a sort of controversy that happened a few months ago when she was talking about contraception and he called her, the words that circulated widely were that he had called her a slut and a prostitute, but his actual, if you were to look at the transcript from the 3 days that he discussed her most extensively, it was an unbelievable tirade, so much more dramatic than those two words suggest. He said repeatedly that she had so much sex, it was amazing she could even walk, and all sorts of unbelievable, you know, he wants us to pay for it, she wants us to pay for it, get to watch. I mean, he was really, really crass. And a lot of advertisers withdrew ads in that time frame. But he's still on the air. And what we don't know and we're starting to look at is what is the long-term fallout for, I mean, for him as an individual, he still has a $400 million contract, so he's doing okay. But what is the long-term outcome? It's pretty rare to see that sort of pushback, though it can happen, right? So it's a negotiated level of offensiveness, I suppose. But it, as you said, you have to be pretty far out there to have a real, you know, sort of problem. Otherwise, it just helps the program usually.
Is it too easy to say that much of the outrage industry comes from the far right of the American political spectrum? I mean, talk radio is dominated by conservative talk show hosts, but in your analysis of cable TV and radio, and I don't know if you even looked on the internet, I mean, did the numbers bear this out?
Yeah, so, I mean, there is sort of that perception that the right is worse, and so that was one of the things we wanted to study, and what we found is that As you look at low levels of outrage or the number of times that someone on a specific episode or in a blog post or on a radio broadcast does something outrageous, that the left and right are pretty equal in terms of the number of times, and they're sort of equally likely to be engaged in that. But we find the more outrage is used, when you get into cases where a lot is being used in a given case, the more likely the speaker or the writer is to be conservative. So, yes, the right is using considerably more overall outrage and more per episode. Mm-hmm. And this is magnified then by the the sort of sense that there's more of it is magnified that there are more conservative outlets. To begin with, as you mentioned, talk radio is over 90% conservative in terms of the marketplace. So there is more of it happening on the right. Having said that, the worst offenders on the left are just as bad as the worst ones on the right. So there's one in particular, Mike Malloy, who has a particularly venomous program that's similar to something maybe like Michael Savage on the right. The difference, though, is that Mike Malloy is in 13 markets, whereas someone like Limbaugh is in 600 markets. Mm-hmm. So conservative, they can be just as nasty, but they have much smaller reach. There's just no Limbaugh equivalent on the left.
Sarah Soberoy, my last question for you is that on the one hand, you can look at this the proliferation of the outrage industry as a perhaps distasteful but still celebration of free speech in America. But what it comes down to, I think what people are most concerned about and want to know is what effect does it have on the American political system?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. The research is mixed. I mean, on one hand, we think that there are some effects when it comes to policymaking. So one of the things that happens in these spaces is a constant drumbeat of vilification when it comes to collaboration or compromise. So that if you're, in Congress and you're a moderate Republican and you want to work across the aisle, every vote becomes in some ways a test of party purity. And if you fail, you're going to face criticism for that.
And on the other hand?
But on the other hand, we see at the level of the individual that fans may turn out more often to the polls. They may become more involved in politics. It can be mobilizing. Whether this is the best populace that you want to have participating, if they're given misinformation, is another question. But it can be encourage political participation.
Sarah Soberoy is Associate Professor of Sociology at Tufts University and co-author of the forthcoming book, The Outrage Industry. Thanks so much for joining us today, Professor Soberoy.
Thanks, Magna.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. It's been a long but great week, everyone. I hope you have a restful weekend and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.